Accession number 23329, reel 19.
Sorry, 19. Tell Younger, reel 19.
And reel... We watched the same Feldwebel examine the lock on a wooden shed, in which the Germans kept various tools, such as cross-cut saws, hammers, and so on. Well, several times POWs had forced their way in and acquired some of the tools. At this time, when the Feldwebel had gone, one of the prisoners kicked a wall of the shed, and there was a bit of movement of a board, so he kicked several times more, and it was enough. The building then was descended upon by countless prisoners and literally kicked to pieces. Within 5 minutes, there was no sign that it had ever existed. And there was a procession of guilty wood carriers making their way to their barracks. The Feldwebel, who had been visiting the cookhouse, found himself among prisoners whose arms were full of wood, and he was a little bit nonplussed at first, but then he realized that his shed was no more. He became very angry indeed, and got hold of his pistol and fired a number of shots, not so much, I think, to warn the prisoners, but just to, well, as a means of self-expression, I would think. One Kriege took fright, and he threw away his bundle of wood, and it dived through the wide open window of the cookhouse, whereupon water gushed through the window, and it was seen that he'd gone head first into a boiler, fortunately, of cold water. This placated the Feldwebel to some extent. He couldn't contain his mirth. Very hungry, and to improve our lives, Dick took a job in the cookhouse. It brought him into contact with German guards and also Russian workers, and in exchange for cigarettes, he managed to get a small quantity of firewood and some spring onions, which he shared with not just the four of us, but the whole eight. Some of the Russians seemed to have unusual privileges, and they were a different type from the Mongol-featured Russians who predominated. They seemed to be of a different class and were treated differently. I remember shortly after we arrived at Felingbostel, I saw a party of Russian prisoners dragging a heavy handcart. Their guards actually carried whips and occasionally gave them a lash, but they didn't seem too worried about that. But when they came level with our tin dump near the fence, the Russians dropped their handcart and they fell upon their knees and and got their fingers into all the tins, winkling out any smear of food that was left. You know, I couldn't help remembering T.B. Miller's little saying, every little bit of nutriment counts, as he did much the same thing, but not with tins that were left on a dump. Stinks, gosh. We've only been there a few days then. Yeah, on the 16th of August, which was quite soon after we moved into the camp at Fellingbostel, we saw a large-scale daylight raid for the first time. We oldies had never seen anything like the vast array of bombers and the shoals of fighters surrounding them. There were fortresses and liberators, 1,000 of them this time, and they boomed overhead, and the fighters protected them against other fighters, but not against flak, and every now and then we saw one of the American bombers hit and fall in flames, and sometimes there would be a cluster of white dots, which were parachutes, gently falling, but very often there was no sign of parachutes. And we wondered sometimes what had held the men in their disintegrating aircraft. Sometimes we would see a lame duck playing when all the others had gone, struggling to get home. The air raid siren sounded fairly often at this time, and then the compounds were sealed. If we were in another compound, we had to stay there. And there were angry scenes sometimes as prisoners defied orders to return to their rooms, wanting to watch what was happening in the sky. And it was only when guns were produced that people went back into their rooms. It was wise to stay with a group and to stay near the door. Gautier was in another compound, and of course he should have stayed there when the siren sounded. But he sauntered across the big main compound, and each time he was halted by the guards, he exercised his charm and was allowed to go on. But when he got back to his own barrack, Buck said, "Where the hell have you been, Junior?" He was just like a parent whose anxiety for a missing child had given way to relief when the child had returned unharmed. Junior only grinned. From under his jacket, he took a small painting on 3-ply wood, and this was for me. He had traded some pencil sketches of mine for the painting, which had been the work of a Frenchman who lived in the Vorlage. It was the first oil painting I ever owned. Cover. Many of us were suffering from dysentery at this time, and one army man died, and we watched him followed to the grave by a dozen scruffy old Germans who looked as if they'd been put into uniform especially to represent the Reich on this occasion. We heard a ragged rifle bolt volley, and that was the end of one man's war and his life. We were rejoined at Fellingbostel by the Poles from Thorn, and they were very excited to be with us again, and they felt safer being a few among thousands. They hailed Dixie Deans as their saviour and refused to accept his disclaimer that his efforts had influenced the Germans in any way. It was a strange existence. Nothing seemed stable anymore. Nothing was planned. We just lived from incident to incident, hoping that the Allies were going to press through quickly to liberate us. There were a few cigarette parcels came. I had several from 460 Squadron. Whenever I received any cigarettes, I used to go over to V compound to take some to two South African Army NCOs to whom I'd been introduced by Nielsen White, the man I'd met at Tor, and for some reason they never seemed to get any cigarettes. Carlyle had been the night editor of a newspaper in Durban, and he became something of a hero figure for me. Richardson was a dark, alert man, and he was an artist. Prevailing mood of the camp was optimism, but somehow I had a hunch that we'd be spending another winter in Germany. I needed winter clothes for 600 cigarettes, very precious cigarettes. I bought a blanket and another 70, well, more than that. I bought two sets of underwear at 70 cigarettes per garment. New prisoners were coming in. There were men captured at Kahn, and they reckoned that the war would end by December at the latest. A rather sceptical Canadian thought otherwise, and he climbed over the wire one night in thick fog. He had a few days of freedom, but then was captured and returned to the camp and sentenced to the usual spell of solitary confinement. However, he may have been lucky, because we had been warned that there were now security zones where anyone found wandering would be shot at sight. But we hadn't been told where the boundaries were. We were told in warning notices in letters 6 feet high, escape is no longer a sport. Nat Lehman, who had been caught trying to escape from Heidekrug and whose capture had been the main factor in the collapse of Grimson's network, had been taken to Hanover to be tried by a German military court for his attempted escape at Heidekrug, and there were other charges which were rather more serious to do with his possession of documents and items that a normal escaping prisoner would not have. Peter Thomas was allowed to appear for the defence, and he was very pleasantly surprised when German officers were very fair, and they took the view that Lehmann had committed no crime, but the admirable one of attempting to escape. And he was sentenced to 3 weeks solitary confinement, which is the same as he would have received had he been punished summarily. And he must have been very thankful for the bath that he had taken in the laundry boiler at Heidekrug when Dixie managed to get his uniform and identity tags to him. For one issue of half a parcel per man on September the 8th, there were no Red Cross parcels. The rations given us by the Germans were bread, potatoes and soup, which was made from dried vegetable at that time. The army laid claim to a quantity of clothing which arrived at the camp, and Dixie, though rather dubious of the claim, made no protest. The Germans were, or appeared to be, making efforts to divide us into warring factions, and Dixie had no wish to further their aims. There were differences between the army and the RAF, and they were fostered by the German guards, not so much deliberately, but because they were army men themselves with no great liking for their own airmen, and so they were prejudiced in favour of the army prisoners. They regarded a soldier as an honest tradesman like themselves, and they recognised that they could have been prisoners themselves. But on the other hand, the RAF men were destroyers of their fatherland, and they were just charitably allowed to live. At this time, almost as if to emphasize the point, three thunderbolts flew over the camp at 50 feet. One of them had a shot at a postern box, and then at night the bombs fell so close to the camp that we thought we'd been mistaken for a German town. Some Kriegies dived under their beds. These were mosquitoes who were pinpoint bombing the SS regiment barracks that we'd passed down the road. Now, optimism didn't last very long. The rain came and seemed endless. Mud was churned up by 20,000 restless boots inside the barracks, or our barracks, the stone ones. It was so dark that it was sometimes impossible even to read the title page of a book. And so I used to go over to our compound, to the wooden huts, and share Nielsen White's bunk with him, and with Norman Hennessy, who, like Nielsen, was to be ordained after the war. He studied theology and Hebrew. I read international trade and industrial organization for an Oxford diploma in economics. With the rain drumming down ceaselessly, we hardly left our half-dark barracks, except to go to the latrines or to go on a pill or to collect rations. They were hardly worth collecting, soup or millet, both gritty. Occasionally a little Red Cross food arrived. Buck volunteered to cut brushwood outside the camp. He had his eyes on the commandant's cabbage patch. I'm not sure how he knew it was there, but he did. It was pretty risky, but day after day he managed to defeat the vigilance of the guards, and he would bring in a cabbage concealed in the stack of brushwood. The appels or roll calls were enlivened by the presence of a new counter, and he was a little corporal with a twitch who could count only in fives, and if one file happened to be incomplete, he was quite perplexed, and he would sometimes count it as a file of five, hoping he was right, or else he begged us to tell him how many we were. He was always the last of the counters to report to the officer in charge, who would begin to bellow sarcastically, which just increased the poor little man's twitch. So he, up and down our lines he'd go. He was very panicky, just like a newly caged bird. He kept glancing over his shoulder and imploring us to tell him how many, please, how many. And we would relent, and he would enter the figure in his book, and mustering his dignity, he would march to the officer in the centre while the Kriegers whistled a tune to which there were rude lyrics, probably in German as well as in English. On one occasion, as he approached the German officer, the officer gave him the equivalent of double man, double, and the little corporal spurted to a trot, and as he gathered himself to throw a really impressive Nazi salute, he went flat on his belly, his arms still outstretched, his fingers almost touching the jackboot of his officer. He was flat in the mud, and the rain kept soaking into his back. We heard the roar of American engines far above the clouds, and leaflets fell into the camp, and prisoners raced to pick them up. Of course, for the German civilians, the penalty for having leaflets was death, and the same thing applied to the prisoners. Germans searched the camp, and leaflets which hadn't been put away for souvenirs, they found pasted on the walls. So perhaps as a result of this, I don't know, the Gestapo swarmed in, but we did get a warning from the guards, who liked the Gestapo no more than we did. We were marched to the Dillasa for a personal search, and again we had to go naked, and then the Gestapo searching the rooms objected to the presence of room leaders in the barrack. This was a practice which had been established as far back as 1942. We won our point, but they took no notice and just methodically wrecked the barracks, even tore up clothing. Over the wall, over my bed, I had put up some rather uncharitable caricatures of Nazi leaders. And Toby asked me, are you going to leave them there? I said they can do what they like about it, which was rather a dangerous attitude, I think. Now, Bill Bohe was our camp leader, and he told me afterwards what had happened. He said that the searchers were furious, and they wanted to ferret out the culprit, me, and have him punished. I think Bill might have been exaggerating a bit, but he said they hadn't been able to decide whether the firing squad or a nearby concentration camp best fitted the crime. Bohill intervened. He explained that the artist really admired the German leaders. He wasn't quite in accord with their viewpoint, but it was because of his admiration that he'd made the drawings. And Bill went on that unfortunately, being little experienced, the artist had allowed distortion to creep in. He said the same unhappy result had attended his effort to capture Bill's own likeness, and to prove the point, he produced my caricature of himself. And I think it was that that placated the Germans. They declared that nevertheless such irreverences couldn't be allowed to survive, and they ripped the caricatures to pieces. During the search, Dixie Deans patrolled the camp. He wanted to prevent any ugly scenes, if that were possible, because one hothead could provoke an incident of great gravity, and he did, in fact, smooth away a number of difficulties, though he didn't hesitate to protest against the methods of the secret police. One objection angered one Gestapo man who flew at Deans and got his fingers round his throat, and he was a little chap, and with his feet literally off the ground. He clung there, digging in his vicious fingers. One of the camp officers, seeing what was happening, just turned his back. He was afraid to interfere. Deans didn't hit the Gestapo man, but finally succeeded in shaking him off. But he decided to report the man at once. At the gate, the guard stood aside, and Deans went into the commandant's office. But the commandant, an oberst colonel, just shrugged, his gesture implying that, well, they were in this together. And on his way back to the compound, Dean saw a man lying by the roadway. He was the victim of an epileptic fit, and it was the officer who had turned his back and refused to help him. Deans routed out some German officers and sent them to the aid of their superior.